are some who aren't going to do this, aren't here. Okay, so this is December 29. Is that correct? Did I say December? I wanted to get the 29 right, and I got the wrong date. This is November 29, and this is Biochemistry 421, and we're dealing with overhead number 10 in chapter number 20. And I'm recording this to those individuals who can't make it because of class conflicts that normally occur on Thursday. Nothing else is here. Let me just get rid of this. Just pick that up. And we managed to get all the fatty acids. I'll just ask a question. Name the enzyme that's on the interior of the capillaries that hydrolyzes the fats and produces fatty acids from the chylomicrons from digestion. Did you know there was that? What is it? There you go. There's a lipase that is in the circuit, that sticks out into the circulatory system and latches onto these chylomicrons and releases fatty acids that then diffuse into the intercellular region, interstitial fluid, as it were. There are transporters, and there's also a diffusion that moves it into the cell. So from now on, we're looking at what's happening inside the cell now that we've completed how things get into the body. So we got into the body, it's in the body, it's now into the cell, what happens? And that's an excellent question. What does happen? And there was an elegant experiment in 1904 by Franz Knuth. I don't know if they pronounce the K or not, but whatever. He fed dogs labeled fatty acids. That is, he put benzene rings on the fatty acid tail end. You can see that right here. Put a benzene ring there. Here's the fatty acid. Put that on the end. And it's amazing that he was actually able to do that with organic chemistry, is to get that benzene ring back there. This was how many years ago, ladies and gentlemen? 1904 means it was how many? 108 years ago. Do you understand when you look at the entire breadth of human history, how little, how just recently 104 years ago is, or 108 years ago is? It's just a blink. And from that point, we've just accelerated understanding of biochemistry. This is why this class is so hard. There's so much. I'm just giving you a mere touch of it. Okay, anyway. So, odd-chain fatty acids produce hippouric acid, which is, you get this, in order to increase this particular material, this benzoic acid's solubility, the body in the liver typically adds a glycine residue to increase the solubility, and that's what's excreted by the kidneys. Yeah. Even chain fatty acids produce phenylacetic acid. He did that with a variety of even and odd chain fatty acids, and it always produced either this, if it was, I just lost my pointer, this, or the phenylacetic acid. Yay. So, I don't actually, you know, when you're looking at your pointer, that doesn't matter, I guess. So, you produce either this or that, and so from this, and we're not going to get into the logic of it, perhaps you should as you ponder this, why he was able to determine it produced it was cut off in series of twos, that this was the process that he discovered based on this idea that the oxidation of fatty acids occurred in carbon units of two. Carbon units of two. All right, now, so that fundamental piece of information is available. We know the oxidation occurs in series of twos, two carbon units. But he didn't know a lot of the chemistry that was going on before all that occurred, and this is the start of it. Before any action, any oxidation of the fatty acids occur, they have to be activated. They have to be activated. And so you take a fatty acid, any fatty acid, medium chain, short chain, long chain, they all have to be activated. You begin with ATP, and there's an enzyme right here, And what I want you to do is to look on the next page. Is this even so good that I can't even do that? All right. I'm going to have to make sure I bring, I have batteries with me on this. Okay, all right. So interpretation, fatty acid oxidation occurs by degradation in two carbon units, confirmed in the 1950s. What that means is it was confirmed by radioactivity labeling. Radioactivity labeling did not become a prominent way of marking carbons until after World War II, because after World War II was when many of the insights about how radioactivity and how it behaved came into being because of the war effort. So that's the interpretation. It would be wise for you to examine that. And then we go on and we talk about this aspect. Now, this, there's a particular enzyme we're going to be seeing on the next page. Acyl-CoA synthetase is the name of it. Acyl-CoA synthetase. And it produces, it consumes an ATP, creates a temporary high-energy intermediate, this acyl-demylate mixed in hydride. CoA comes in and you get this acyl-CoA. The acyl-CoA simply is that long-chain fatty acid that now has the coenzyme attached to it. And that's a high-energy thioester bond right there, that high-energy thioester bond with that acyl-CoA. Let's take a look at the next page here. We're still talking about fatty acid activation. So the previous chart is dealing with this diagram. So this is the caption for the previous diagram. Fatty acids become high-energy intermediates after the activation of a group of enzymes called acyl-CoA synthetases. Underline that. That's the activating enzyme that provides that high-energy intermediate that's used to transport and to begin the oxidation process of it. Each of synthetases, there's a whole family of them. They have their own specific specificities, as you can see here. Notice where this occurs. The activation occurs where? What's the diagram say? The cytosol. The activation occurs in the cytosol. Final product, of course, is that acyl-CoA. The hydrolysis of the pyrophosphate. That PPI is pyrophosphate. It's two phosphates together. There is a tremendous free energy that comes from the breaking apart of that pyrophosphate into two individual phosphates, and that really helps drive, that free energy release helps drive the reaction to completion. The cellular fatty acid is now ready to enter the mitochondria for beta oxidation. Now again, the activation occurred in the cytosol, but the oxidation occurs in the mitochondria, in the matrix of the mitochondria. Doink. All right, let's move it into the mitochondria. Again, interior, the inner mitochondrial membrane is 70% proteins, very little fatty acids, turns out to be, or phospholipids. It's almost all transport protein. Long-chain acyl-CoAs cannot cross the inner mitochondrial membrane. Acyl-carnitines can. Because enzymes called carnitine palmitoyl oil transferases 1 and 2 exchanges that group for a carnitine. So acyl-carnitines are actually what's transferred across the inner mitochondrial membrane by enzymes called, let's list it there, carnitine carrier proteins. And let's see here. Okay, let's get to this. And I apologize for the somewhat crammed thing. So you have carnitines, you get diffused across the inner mitochondrial membrane. Don't you just love this? So, food supplement makers have claimed that carnitine is a fat burner. Is this justified? So let's take a look at what's actually happening here. Again, this is one of the diagrams that came from that second page. Okay, I think the second page is a better diagram, clearer diagram, but this turns out okay. Again, we're dealing with the inner mitochondrial membrane. Here's a cytosol. Here's the activated long-chain fatty acid. Here's carnitine. There's an exchange. You release just CoA here. OA, and you get this acyl carnitine. That simply moves it across. You now have that same fatty acid carnitine in the interior. It exchanges back again, and you have that that high energy activated acyl CoA now in the interior in the matrix, and carnitine is now free to do the same thing again. You know, I am not honestly certain. This one of billions of questions I'm going to get to ask when I get to heaven. I'm not sure why this is necessary. Why can't you just transport the fat across using a CoA carrier? I don't know why it transfers to this. You may find in medical school or graduate school they may explain that. Perhaps they have a reason. I don't know. It just is. But
what's carnitine?
What's carnitine? Well, carnitine is an amino acid-like material. Thank you for asking. It's over here. This is carnitine. It sort of looks like an extended amino acid. You have this amine group here, an acid over here, but it's not a classic amino acid, as you can tell, because it's not structured that way. But it is simply, as it says here, it's this simple amine carboxylic acid group, and it attaches, the esters attach to that hydroxy group, and you get that acyl carnitine. I don't know. It's a relatively small compound, a small molecule. Perhaps that's one reason why they use it to carry. Yes.
Well, I was thinking maybe the charges you have there, the positive
sure.
charges, because you know if it's going across the membrane, the inside is going to be polar, right?
Yeah. Well, certainly we know that because of the charges that exist here on a physiological basis, that it won't diffuse across. We know that. I don't know what the mechanism is. Perhaps the protein, as you say, because of the charges and the relatively small size of it, as opposed to CoA. Remember how big CoA is? You don't? You remember what the CoA looks like? Okay. Allow me to get my sword, and may I call on it ceremonially, because chemists don't know what CoA looks like. Okay. Let's see if we can reproduce this, even from my somewhat rusty memory. CoA. All right. Anybody remember the components of what CoA is? Obviously, at the top there's a what?
Thiol.
A thiol. And then down here, I think there's a 2-carbon unit. And then you get this thing called pantothenic acid. Remember me talking about pantothenic acid? And then there's a ribose down here. And then there's adenosine. I don't have all the structures, but it's a pretty big thing. Okay. So you got a sulfur, I think you got an ethanolamine here. You've got pantothenic acid, a ribose, and adenosine. So it's a fairly big molecule. It's much larger than this carnitine is. So perhaps that's the reason why they exchange it. It's just easier to carry that small carnitine across rather than that acetyl-CoA, the CoA group. All right, well, anyway, short-chain acyl-CoAs can simply diffuse across. What do you know? There's one thing we've discovered that actually just diffuses across the inner mitochondria. One of the few things that do. Would you claim that carnitine is a fat burner in this context? If you, now that you know the function of it, could you claim that it's a fat burner?
Well, if you are deficient in carnitine,
then this process would be slowed. But if you have a normal metabolism, I would suspect that you've got plenty of carnitine for this to occur, and it's simply claims that are not really justified. Okay. So now you know when you see and you go into GNC and they see these things at carnitine and fat burner, now you know the biochemistry behind it. Let's take a look at what happens once that acyl-CoA gets into the matrix. You see that there are four enzymes right here. You have the fatty acyl-CoA,
is the original material that comes from the digestive tract. You have the acyl-CoA dehydrogenase. Now, I told you many months ago I was going to show you my favorite enzyme in biochemistry, and it's that one, the acyl-CoA dehydrogenase. You don't need to write that down. That's simply, it is what it is. Now, why would this enzyme be my favorite one? Because of the following chemistry that it does. Notice, it takes a saturated carbon bond and in a single step extracts two hydrogens and two electrons in a single step and goes from a saturated to an alkene, from an alkane to an alkene in a single step. There is no chemistry that I know of that exists at 37 degrees Celsius in a water-based solution at one atmosphere pressure that'll do that. There's no organic chemistry that'll do that. This is an enzyme that does something we cannot do at those conditions. And not only that, those electrons that enter in the electron transport system and are used to make ATP. It's amazing. But that's the critical step in this. Because once you now have the double bond, then what do? The double bond? You add water to it and you make a what? What functional group is that? It's an alcohol. Then what do? The alcohol? You then what? Oxidize it. Then what happens? Then this thiolase comes in, breaks that bond there, puts another CoA group right there. You got acetyl-CoA as a product, and now you have the same material ready to go back and do it again. Remove the hydrogens. Make a double bond. Put water on it. Make an alcohol. Oxidize that alcohol to make a ketone. Break that ketone. Start the whole thing all over again. Boom, 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 boom. It's organic chemistry live right now in each one of your cells. It's fantastically simple, extraordinarily elegant, and you get lots of energy out of it. You get NADH there, you get an FADH up there, you get acetyl-CoA, and under normal circumstances, where does that acetyl-CoA go to? Assuming you need the energy, where does it go to? What's it? Krebs cycle. Is that what you're saying? Krebs cycle. Yeah, goes to the Krebs cycle. Anyway, and you do that 6 to 8 times, and you get it all done. It's fantastic. Let's take a look at this next slide here. Any length, acyl-CoA can be reactive to this product. The pathway products are acetyl-CoA, FADH2, NADH+, and 2-carbon acyl-CoA. Reaction 1 is a dehydrogenation reaction. That's the tough one, right? A dehydrogenation. Number 2 is a hydration reaction. Write down hydration. Hydration. Number 3 is an oxidation reaction. And number 4 is a Claisen ester cleavage reaction. Remember that from organic chemistry? Claisen ester cleavage or Claisen ester reaction? What in the world do you get out of this? Well, that's the ATP production for one fat molecule composed of 3 palmitic fatty acids and glycerol. We're just right now going to look at the 3 fatty acids. So, each palmitic acid molecule has to be activated, alright? So, that's 2. So this is for each molecule. There's 3 of them here. So there's 2 costs. There's 2 of them cost to be activated. There's an ATP cost of 2 to be activated. You guys understand what I'm talking about? Why the ATP cost is 2 to be activated? Shall we review? Do I have to go all of that? That's fine. I do. Escape. Escape while there's time, ladies and gentlemen. Escape while there's time. I know this is tough to see, but you notice what happens here? ATP goes to AMP. We've lost how many phosphates? 2. That's equivalent of 2 ATP being consumed. That's where that comes from in the activation process. And where are we here? Is that it? Yeah, there it is. Let's go here. each round. So you then have each round of oxidation for the three, for each of the acetyl-CoAs that you get. All right? So you, for each acetyl-CoA that goes through, each round that you go through, you get one FADH2 that's worth two ATP. You make 14 of those because you do that seven times. One ADH, each one of those is worth three ATP. Remember, this is the P-O ratio. Approximately 3. You get 21 because you do that 7 times. 1 acetyl-CoA every time. So you get, for each acetyl-CoA, you get 9, 2, and 1. And since you're doing this 7 times, 7 rounds, okay, you get 9 times 7 is 63. 9 times 14, that's a 1. Then, and then you have that last little bit, that last acetyl-CoA, final round acetyl-CoA, actually makes two of them then. You get, you get this, you add this all up, 129 ATP per fatty acid. Yes?
Why is it not the last final round acetyl-CoA? How come it's not multiplied by 7 for the total?
Well... Well, there is...
So it's each round on the first stop, and then that is at the end.
At the end.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Okay, so, so this is what happens during the breakdown, and at the last time it goes through this, you make two acetyl-CoAs, and that's why I just separated the eighth one out and separated at least individually. So you make 120 ATP. That means all three fatty acids in a single molecule of fat produce, I don't know if that's on the next page, but it produces a bunch. No, it doesn't. Let's go back here. So three times this is what you get, the number of ATP for a single fat molecule. Plus glycerol. Don't forget we haven't talked about what happens when you oxidize glycerol. So there's... What, three times? We call that 130 times three, so it's 390 ATP for every fat molecule. Yes?
So the PO ratio is 54?
No, the PO ratio.
For 18. Well, for the three, right?
Well, the PO ratio is actually not related to this directly, per se.
You said something about the PO ratio.
Right, I did, and that is. That's this 2 versus 3 ATP for every FAD and NADH. As this set of electrons, FADH2, goes through the electron transport system, it pumps only approximately 2, and I notice I'm having to say approximately 2 protons as it moves through the electron transport system. So the best estimate is that every set of electrons that come from, that are donated from an FAD, provides approximately 2 ATP equivalents. Because NADH is more strongly reduced as it goes to the electron transport system and actually goes through more pumping. Remember, these electrons that are donated by NADH go through 3 pumps, not 2. Remember that? And so that provides the 3 ATP equivalents for NADH.
What confuses me is the other day that I asked about this insulin, I was mentioning the number of oxidations versus the number of ATP that you produce. And I thought that wasn't related to the PO ratio, but now it seems to be related.
Well, the number of oxidations, actually, the O in the... My understanding of the PO, and it varies sometimes between who's defining it, the P relates to the number of ATP produced.
Right.
And the O represents the number of oxygen, not oxidizing oxygen, not the number of oxidizing steps, but the number of actual atoms of oxygen in which those electrons are dumped onto.
Right, but with the explanation you just gave, wouldn't that mean that it's related to the number of oxidations? Because you're going from FADH2 to some, reduced form or something.
The number of oxidations of the fatty acid or the number of oxidations of the electron transport system?
Well, I thought you were talking about the electron transport system.
I am. Perhaps that's something we can clarify outside of class.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the questions.
Let's go ahead, shall we? And now, if all you do is eat meat, you're only going to get even chain fatty acids. However, us plant eaters are going to run across odd chain fatty acids. And so what happens is the following. Metabolism of odd chain fatty acids, unsaturated and unsaturated fatty acids. Odd chain fatty acids. The final round. Oh, good night.
What happened here?
The final round here produces a propionyl-CoA. Huh? The final round of an odd chain fatty acid yields a propionyl-CoA. So, let's say you have 9. 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 8. I gotta make sure. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay. So you get cut off 2, 2, 2, and the last round produces an acid that's an acetyl group that's not got 2 carbons, but it's got how many? 3. That's with odd chains. Odd. Now, it has a special purpose. It ends up going a particular way. All right? The propionyl-CoA enters the pathway on the right. First reaction consumes ATP and carbon dioxide, uses a biotin prosthetic group to get to the carbon dioxide on the substrate to make the S-methylenyl-CoA. Resembles pyruvate in some respects. And it resembles a pyruvic carboxylase reaction. Third reaction is catalyzed by methylmalonyl-CoA mutase. Guess what that is? Uses 5-deoxyadenosylcobalamin as a prosthetic group.
What product does that come from?
Cobalamin or vitamin B12. This is one of 2 chemical reactions known to use vitamin B12 in the human body. It's 2 is the last time I heard. 2. And this is it. You always wonder why you need such microscopic amounts of vitamin B12? It's because of that mutase. Notice what it does. It changes a branched chain carbon structure into a straight chain carbon structure. Vitamin B12 cofactor rearranges the carbon skeleton from branched into straight chain. You can see that over here as well. Catalyzing carbon skeleton rearrangement. Second of it all, we're in 2 vitamin B12 acquired reactions. The other involves folate metabolism. Hopefully we'll get to that. So here's a carbon skeleton. Is this branch? Just rearranges it to form succinyl-CoA. Here is vitamin B12. Remember when I had you duplicate it? Notice, again, it's got that porphyrin center, but what element is in the center of that porphyrin center?
Cobalt.
And to my knowledge, and according to what I've been told, this is the only known cobalt carbon bond in nature. Is that bond within vitamin B12? Cobalt and carbon bond that occurs naturally in nature is in vitamin B12. Unbelievable, ladies and gentlemen. Unbelievable. Absolutely fantastic chemistry. If you want to study something fascinating, I would go in and do some cobalt chemistry using vitamin B12. Now, so you get, what is the ultimate fate? What's the intermediate that you get when you have an odd chain fatty acid? The intermediate product is that propionyl-CoA, and it gets changed into what? Let's get changed into. Just like this. What was the end of that? Let me go back. Okay, we cannot forget this, ladies and gentlemen. We start up here with propionyl-CoA. We go through this process. I didn't ask you to memorize it. I understand that. But you go through methylmalonyl-CoA, racemase, and you go to this methylmalonyl-CoA mutase, circle it, indicating the prominence of vitamin B12, but that changes the propionyl-CoA into a what? from three carbons into what? Well, that's not the end of the story, but we'll see you a little bit more later. Unsaturated fatty acid metabolism. Everybody loves unsaturated fats. Of course, when you're eating lots of vegetable oils and stuff, you're getting lots of unsaturated fats. How in the world do you do that? This is where I claim bacteria are smarter than mammals. Here, we'll take a look what that means. Certain unsaturated fatty acids have double bonds in the incorrect position to act as substrates in the beta oxidation pathway. Huh? What? Let's take a look at this. Here is a particular round of the top there. The double bond is out of position for the enol-CoA hydratase. In other words, you're adding the water to the fatty acid, to the double bond of the fatty acid oxidation to make an alcohol, and it's in the wrong place. Notice up there, and I don't have my pointer.
Could I borrow one? I can't borrow your question.
Sure.
Iterate. You know, they claim that if you put three boys on a deserted island, that in the first 3 minutes, one of them will find a stick that's in the shape of a gun. Okay, I don't know what it is about guys and guns, but anyway. So, up here, ladies and gentlemen, up here we find this. Notice the beta oxidation, two there. But notice, under normal circumstances, where would that double bond be in order to where should it be in order to continue the oxidation of the oxidation process? It should be, yes, between the alpha and the beta, but there's actually between the beta and the gamma. So there's an enzyme that exists in the interior of your mitochondria, that enol-CoA isomerase, that shifts it one and then allows it to move. Okay? Then what happens is the following. It goes through first one round and first oxidation the next round, and you end up then getting a situation where you have a double bond that's conjugated. Well, that conjugated double bond, as you know, throws off the chemistry of all this. Throws off all the organic chemistry of it. So the body, and this is where we discover that bacteria are smarter than us. Solution one, use an isomerase to move the double bond to the correct position. Problem number two, conjugated double bond is created by the formation of that trans 2, and notice that delta is the position number of the double bond. Enol-CoA during the first day of oxidation, you're an already present double bond. It creates that resonance structure right there. This solution to mammalian uses two enzymes. Well, what happens is it comes along and it reduces one of the two double bonds, puts it in the wrong position, then rearranges it so it's in the right position, and then continues on with beta oxidation. Notice it uses the NADPH, not the NADH. NADPH, PPP for biosynthesis, and there it is using for being broken down. What do you know? Okay, so, but notice what happens with the bacteria. E. coli uses a single enzyme, accomplishes the same two activities. So the bacteria will take, they break down fats just like we do. They take that conjugated double bond, reduce it, and rearrange it in a single enzyme activity, and goes on with beta oxidation. Fantastic chemistry, ladies and gentlemen. Excellent. Now, let's go back. Let's go back to days of yore. I'm not sure where that is, but let's go back to days of yore. What happens to that succinate from odd-shaped fatty acid remnant? It enters the citric acid cycle indirectly, ladies and gentlemen. Indirectly. Let's take a look what that means. So writing the word indirectly, writing the not, writing pyruvate. All right. So let's just take a look. Fate of that odd chain fatty acid, right? It enters the citric acid cycle temporarily and indirectly and temporarily. Excess succinate enters the TCA through pyruvate. It's made as malate, and then that leaves the TCA. Usually the enzyme, malic enzyme, produces pyruvate. The same enzyme that's used in the C4 cycle of the spice. Notice the use of NAD. Here's you have malate. Okay, so how do we get malate out of this? What in the world are you talking about, Dr. Novak? Go back to the citric acid cycle. Right? And is there the compound malate in the citric acid cycle? Yeah. So you enter it, just mentally remember this. This is why I had you memorize this stuff. So you enter in succinate. That succinate then goes to what? Fumarate. Fumarate then goes to malate. Remember that? Okay. So then the malate exits, for reasons I can't explain. Malate exits and is lost. Carbon dioxide is lost, and you make pyruvate. And from that pyruvate, you can go on if you want to make oxaloacetate, or you could go on and make oxaloacetate actually. And from that oxaloacetate, go on and go up the gluconeogenic pathway to make glucose. So the only fatty acids that can make glucose are odd chain fatty acids, and the only fragment that can do that is the three carbons that are left at the end of the fatty acid oxidation. Did that make sense? Even chain fatty acids cannot make glucose in mammals. Odd chain fatty acids can, in one limited sense. The last fragment of the oxidation is a three-carbon unit that gets changed into a four-carbon unit, which then can be made into glucose using gluconeogenesis. But that's only one last bit of that odd-chain fatty acid. Otherwise, all even-chain fatty acids are doomed not to make glucose. All right. Now, how in the world are there very long chain fatty acids longer than 16 or 18? Yes, there are some that are even longer, 22. And they are actually oxidized directly in another cell structure called the peroxisome. It uses oxygen directly. These things are so long they can't even be handled very well. So they just whack at them with oxygen and break them apart. And they get hydrogen peroxide out of that. And the peroxide is reduced by catalase. Because that peroxide is a very, very dangerous compound to have in the blood, in the body. Now then, I'm going backwards here. All right, next thing. Ketone bodies. I'm trying to get to the first quiz question. We actually have a quiz question, so hang in there. In the liver, you like the liver? I like my liver. Anybody here not like their liver? Ever have goose liver pate?
Yes.
Have you really? What was it like?
Yes.
What was it? I have no idea. I've never had any goose liver. What? Yeah. All right. Anyway, in the liver, a major portion of acetylcholine produced by fat enters a metabolic pathway and produces soluble forms of fat. That sounds odd, but that's absolutely true. Soluble forms of fat. The old style phrase of that is called ketone bodies. Important source of energy equivalents in the blood for the muscle and the brain during starvation. Right? And you'll find ketone bodies in your blood pretty much continually, but they really become prominent during starvation. When is starvation occur? Starvation starts to occur 2 to 3 days after your last meal. If you don't eat for 3 days, you probably have a very high proportion of ketone bodies in your bloodstream. These ketone bodies are in fact ketone chemicals. They're not like a body, like a protein, carbohydrate kind of a structure. They're simply three chemicals. Acetoacetate, acetone, and beta-hydroxybutyrate. Acetone We've got acetone in your bloodstream?
Yes. Yes, you do.
Acetoacetate is a four-carbon unit. Beta-hydroxybutyrate is a four-carbon unit. And acetone, as you see, will eventually be made from the spontaneous breakdown of acetoacetate. Conversion of acetate to beta-hydroxybutyrate. The original material that you find... did I give you a copy of this? Because this is really bad. Remember in that handout? Is this in there?
It's not bad.
No, it's not bad up here. Okay, it's readable at least. It's big enough that the blurriness doesn't matter. Four-carbon unit, I'll show you how it's made on the next slide. You reduce it and you reduce it and you get that beta-hydroxybutyrate. So these two things are closely associated. A single enzyme separates them, and then acetone comes from the spontaneous breakdown of this acetoacetate. Now, this is the first question, finally, 5 minutes in. And I'm not sure you even know this, but we'll find out. Okay? Diabetics often suffer blank, a condition in which acetoacetate levels increase, causing a sweet breath odor. You have ketosis, lipidosis, glycerogenesis, single lipid storage disease, or atherosclerosis. Anybody have a wild idea what this might be? Yes, what is it? Ketosis. It's the excess fatty acids that exist in the blood. Where do most people find ketosis going on? Where do most physicians find ketosis going on? Badly managed diabetics, especially type 1 diabetics, have a bad history of getting ketosis going on. They get, let's take a look at the logic of insulin. What does insulin signal to the body? If you find insulin in the blood, what do you find the body thinking that's in the blood? Too much glucose or too many energy equivalents. You can almost think of it as energy equivalents, even though insulin and glucose are interrelated. They're actually talking about energy equivalents. So if you don't have insulin in your blood, the body is thinking that, wow, I don't have any energy equivalents. And so the body's going, oh no, the rest of the body, especially the liver, going, oh no, the body is starving. I've got to get energy into the blood. That's my job. I'm a glucose buffer. I'm a fatty acid buffer. That's what the liver does. And so the liver starts dumping glucose and fatty acid equivalents. And those are what? Fatty acid equivalents are what? Ketone bodies, which are what? Acetone and what? Now, all right, what is this? What's that functional group? Carboxylic acid. What's this functional group? Boom! So you are diabetic, type 1 especially. You miss your insulin shot. The body says, oh no, I'm starving, and you start dumping ketone bodies. The liver starts dumping ketone bodies into your blood. Two things happen. One of those ketone bodies, acetoacetate, spontaneously forms acetone. You guys know what acetone smells like? Can you imagine getting close to somebody who's comatose on the ground and they're breathing just barely and you smell their breath and guess what it exactly smells like?
Acetone.
And you know immediately what's happened. They have way too many ketone bodies in their blood, which means this is an insulin problem. Okay? What else is happening? These are all acids. What do you think all those excess acids in the bloodstream are doing to the pH of the blood? Making it acidic like crazy. What's the range? What's normal pH? 7.4. What's deadly? 7.2. 7.3? Just rail off an odd number and let's go for it. 7.2 or lower. That's correct. So all these ketone bodies are changing the pH of the blood, and that's why the guy's fainted. That's called what? So the first answer on this, of course, is what you're going to put down letter what? A for ketosis. Now, I think that may be the only one we get to, but that's okay. Now, we're also going to meet tomorrow. We will not be having a full-fledged quiz tomorrow. We'll simply be doing this kind of a thing. Is that okay? I don't understand it. Oh, no. Okay, well, anyway. I thought I'd fix that. Okay. We're going to continue on, ladies and gentlemen. That's ketosis, an excess of fatty acid equivalents. Do you have this in your handout? Oh, there's another slide. There's the thing on the bottom?
Yeah.
It was?
Yeah.
Hold on. Wait, am I going the right direction? Oh, I went ahead a lot. Okay, there's this, and then there's this. Right? No. What am I missing here?
There's this slide on that.
Oh, is that slide? Oh, no.
What happened to that? Oh, no. Really? Oh, bummer. I wonder if I accidentally erased that. Hold on. Okay. Yes.
I think it's slide number 20. I think it just slide number 20.
Oh, there it is. Oh, yeah, I got flipped. Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Okay, well, we got to finish this because I need to go on. All right, so I'm going to keep you longer for 1 minute. So, production of acetoacetate is from acetyl-CoA. So where do you get these two acetyl-CoAs from? Where do you get the two acetyl-CoAs from?
You could either get them from carbohydrate metabolism after pyruvate, or you can get them from what? Say, beta-oxidation of fatty acids.
All right, so you get this thiolase. It makes this acetyl-CoA, this hydroxymethyl glutaryl-CoA synthase, HMG-CoA synthase. This HMG-CoA, beta-hydroxybethyl-mutoglutarate-CoA, I want you to circle that and say, how can I say this? Building block for cholesterol. HMG-CoA, say building block for cholesterol. From this point, you can shift off and make cholesterol from this. This is not the committed step, but this is where HMG-CoA is where cholesterol begins, is right there. But then you have this lyase that breaks it down to acetoacetate and acetyl-CoA, and the whole process starts over again. When you get in the body, when you get into using it, like the brain and red blood cells, beta-hydroxy gets made into acetoacetate, gets made into succinate. That succinate goes in the electron transport system, and we start all over again. So, this is how it's used to make energy. That succinate goes on to the electron transport system, or electron TREFs, right over there. It needs oxygen. This is how you make it. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Turn these things in, but one question in. Lay right on the desk, please. No, the insulin doesn't come as a result of high moving. It's just there constantly monitoring the operation. Remember, monitoring the relevant amount of energy. So this is not a binary situation in terms of insulin moving. It's not the role of sliding the analog scale. So what happens is as your cut empties, then the ratio of insulin becomes and at some point the insulin level and ratio of insulin glucagon changes. Changes and it signals the tissues to begin to respond differently to the different ratios. Correct. I'm talking about the liver.
I'm so sorry.
The pancreas is responding to the glucose levels. As the pancreas responds to glucose levels, indicating, and glucose is sort of like, I can't count all the energy in the blood. I'm just going to look at glucose.
Is this diabetes?
And it uses it kind of as a marker indicating how energy replete it is. Because it's got lots of glucose. Probably got lots of fats. So, the pancreas is the monitor for glucose levels. The beta cells respond, the alpha cells respond, depending on how much glucose is in there, either by releasing insulin or releasing glucose, releasing glucagon, and those molecules are what tell the rest of the body, the other systems in the body, whether or not there's energy or not in the blood. It's an
imprint,
right? A more sophisticated way of looking at it again is to add glucagon to the measure. In other words, that the pancreas is continually secreting insulin and glucagon, depending on how it senses the energy content of the blood is. And if you notice where the insulin is, where the pancreas is, it's ideally suited for that. Because here you have the gut, right? And from the gut, the veins that take the nutrition from the gut all go into this big portal vein. And the portal vein, immediately, the next tissue the portal vein sees is the liver. Liver, but just before the liver is this little tissue, this little small chili. Looks like a big long chili, big chili, like organ that's just off the portal vein. Sits on top of the stomach. Here's the stomach. Sits on top of the stomach, and it is continually monitoring the food, the energy content coming from, being gathered from the intestinal tract into the portal vein and going to the liver, and it's constantly monitoring the energy content of the material coming from the gut, and responds by dumping insulin or glucagon or both into that blood flow, and the liver responds accordingly, depending on whether it sees, if it sees lots of insulin, it means, that's a trigger to tell the liver to begin to remove energy equivalents from the blood. If there's, relative to glucagon, if the ratio changes as your gut empties, there's going to be less liver, less insulin, more glucagon being released by the pancreas, and that signals the liver, I better not continue to take energy from the bloodstream, I better